I hope many of you don't know my work, because what you will hear now is basically a synopsis of previous work. So apologies to Turtu and Laura and Aiden who've heard that before, but I trust many of you haven't heard these things before, so I'll just try. Most of current language change theory is based on speakers and hearers rather than writers and readers. So investigations from that particular angle pose few problems in contemporary linguistics, but can be a big problem when you do socio-historical linguistics, where we do not have speakers and hearers as such, but rather writers and readers. Nevertheless, we find a number of language change theories which explicitly include written language and their models. And two such models are those by Chafe in 1984 and before him Samuels in 1972. Chafe discusses linguistic innovations that can start either in writing or in speaking and then enter into a dialectal relationship in which one or the other is present or absent. So in figure two, for instance, you see a feature which is present in speaking, absent from writing, and then later on is also present in writing. Figure three would present something where you have a feature again being present in speaking and writing, and then is in absence in writing. And figure four is a feature that starts in writing, then is absent from writing and speaking, and resurfaces again in both. I don't really think that this is a particularly helpful model, since not all, simply because it's very hard to understand. And the second thing is, I think the diagrams are not very helpful. And the second point is that it suggests that there's always a delay between the two modes, right? So it's always one or the other, and the other one is delayed. And I think Samuels, before Chafe in 1972, offers us a much more helpful model where you have spoken mode, written mode, a timeline, and then you have A, B, C as the three different processes which are possible. So you would have process C, that's a change that comes from the written mode and later on enters into the spoken mode. B is the opposite, starting in the spoken mode, enters into writing later on. And the important thing here is you can also have changes as in A, which are simultaneously in the spoken and the written mode. So there's no natural preference for one of the two modes, and they could even occur simultaneously. The whole issue is further complicated by the fact that we also need to distinguish between spoken language as such and written language as such. And Angus MacIntosh, one of the founding fathers of the Linguistic Atlas of Late Medieval England, pointed out that there are linguistic features which belong only and exclusively to the spoken mode, to the spoken mode, and only to the written mode, or both. And for MacIntosh, it was important to point out that certain changes only pertain to the written medium, and they called them the W features. When we study scribal factors in linguistic change now, or even scribes as agents of linguistic change, these W features are, of course, of special interests. But we also need to keep in mind that, at least in theory, scribes can also have influence on the levels of phonology, morphology, syntax, lexicon, and so on. So it's not just about written language and orthography itself. In particular, we need to consider the fact that in earlier language stages, and especially before 1500, many language users were illiterate and had to employ scribes in order to write. These writing processes were highly complex. We can find direct and clear dictation, for instance. We can also find drafts which were later then elaborated on by the scribes. We can have manuscripts that were composed as keywords and later on written by the scribes themselves. So these are all different production processes for medieval manuscripts. What this means is that in these processes, scribes may have influenced the linguistic product they were working on. Documents may not be representative of their authors, but of their scribes. Thus, scribes may have had some serious influence on linguistic change. And finally, before we look at two case studies, we should also not forget that scribes in the original sense, that is monastic scribes working in scriptoria, copying manuscripts, were also working under conditions which are not the same as today. Contemporary culture wants to see copies as close to the original as possible. For the Middle Ages, this was not the case. Scribes enjoyed the freedom to change and correct their originals as they deemed fit. And again, this can be an important source of linguistic change. Similarly, we also need to keep in mind that writing in the Middle Ages was a time-consuming and very costly process. I don't think we need to talk about the cost of parchment and vellum and why medieval manuscripts look the way they do, so I think this is all clear to the people in the audience. But this leads me to believe that writing usually was not an ad hoc process, but rather something planned and maybe even supervised by superiors in monasteries, for instance. In the following, I will present two brief case studies that deal with scribes in medieval England. First, I will discuss the role of authors and scribes in the late medieval past and letters, and the aim is to show that scribes may indeed have been less influential than one might think, especially in the domain of morphosyntax. In other words, Samuel's arrow C is of course an option, but only when it comes to the language of authors, not necessarily of scribes. The second case study later on comes from the early Middle English Peterborough Chronicle, that is the last continuation of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Here we see some very interesting scribal innovation that I would like to discuss, particularly with regard to the issue of innovation and diffusion in linguistic change. So this is a study that looks at scribes and Macintosh's W features in the original sense. And as we will see, it's an innovation that in Chafe's sense originated in writing, dropped out again, and then resurfaced in writing later on. But let's begin with the late Middle English Pastern letters and the influence of scribes on the language of the documents they wrote. There's not enough time really here to discuss the Pastern family in greater detail, and there's no need for the socio-historical background here. Suffice it to say that we have 421 documents, or about 450,000 words, from members of the Norfolk Pastern family. 11 male authors, 4 female authors. Here you have an abbreviated family tree of the major players. We can identify about 22 different hands in those documents. So 421 documents written by 22 different hands. The male family members sometimes wrote themselves, sometimes dictated. The female family members, 4 of them, were all illiterate and dictated all their documents. Now, and this is particularly interesting, I think. Some of the letters by female authors, so for instance, Margaret in Generation 2, were written by male family members, right? So the female family members dictated their letters to male family members. So for instance, Margaret dictated some letters to her sons, John 3, John 2, and Edmund 2. They weren't very innovative with their names. So they named all their sons John and Edmund, so you had to give them numbers. There's John 1, who was married to Margaret, and their sons John 2, John 3, and and William was another one. So it's, you can imagine that like John Boy and the Waltons, basically. So Margaret dictated some letters to John 3, John 2, and Edmund 2. Most of them also wrote their own documents as authors and scribes, so they had their own letters. Now, if they had been influential as scribes when they took down their mother's dictation, we must assume that their own writings and their writings as scribes were similar, right? So if they were influential as scribes, their own letters and the letters for their mother should look the same. In reverse, if they were not influential, the letters written for their mother should be different from their own. And there's a very simple test case, which you can see here. That's the object pronoun form in the plural, hem and them. Hem is the old English form, them is the new form coming in from the north, that's the innovative form. And you can, and here and there is just the possessive form, here is old English, there is the modern innovative forms. As you can see here from the figures, the traditional pronoun forms only appear when Edmund II acts as scribe for his mother. He never uses them when he is writing for himself. You see that there's 5, maybe I can point that out to you. Here he uses them 5 times when he's writing for his mother, doesn't use them at all when he's writing for himself. John II has a comparatively high rate of hem. when he's writing for his mother, that's down here, that's four times when he's writing for his mother, only four times them. When he's writing for himself, his own letters, you can see that's three old forms, 98 new forms, so it's very rare when he does it for himself. The figures for John 3 are superficially different, but essentially show the same pattern. When he's writing for himself, he uses him about 40% of the time. When he's writing for his mother, him is almost twice as frequent as modern them. And the possessive forms are even more illuminating. Only about 4% are traditional when he is the author, but when he acts as scribe for Margaret, traditional and modern forms are on a par. In some ways, much more conservative when they wrote for their mother. Unfortunately, the observed frequencies, of course, are too small to allow for any statistical significance tests, but one cannot avoid the impression that the actual author of the letters played a much greater role in the selection of the pronoun forms than the scribe. How else could we explain the reasonably clear preferences that the scribes show in their own writings and which differ from the choices that we see in the dictated letters? A second group of letters that is interesting now consists of letters by different dictating authors, say John and Margaret, that were actually written down by one particular scribe. So we have letters written by two different authors, one single scribe, and a third person, say for instance James Gloyce, who was the family chaplain and a servant, and took down many dictations. And the hypothesis is the same as the one just outlined. If the language in the letters were that of Gloyce, the scribe, they would be linguistically very similar, despite being dictated by different authors. If they are different, this can be due to authors, since the scribe was the same. And indeed, the findings are again illuminating here. Gloyce, when writing for John I, used the possessive pronoun here 9 times in a letter from 1449, and modern there only once. When he was writing for John's wife Margaret in 1469, he uses there 9 times and here not at all. These figures need to be taken with a pinch of salt, however. The temporal distance of 20 years between the letters may have played a role here, right? So there's 20 years between. The language could have changed in those 20 years, since changes happened very quickly in the family, as we were able to show. And now we could compare the findings for Gloyce with that of another scribe, John Wickes. Wickes wrote for both Margaret Parston and John Parston II, Margaret's son. He used the objective pronoun form him twice, but them only once when writing for Margaret in 1465, and in 1469, so shortly afterwards, when writing for John II, he uses him only once, but them twice. Unfortunately, again, the figures are very low here and certainly do not allow for any definite conclusion, but I still think they point in the same direction as those presented before, and they suggest the same tendencies, namely that scribes did not always compose the letters in their own style, but actually paid attention to the forms that the authors used, or at least which they believed to be appropriate for certain authors, so for instance male authors, female authors, young, old, conservative, modern, and so on. The advantage that we have when we compare the two letters written by Wickes is that the letters are of comparable length and were roughly written at the same time. So the figures are low, but then the letters are very comparable, which is an advantage here. So in sum, I think we can say that the scribes on the whole seem to have been much less influential, at least in the domain of morphosyntax, than we might believe. Let us now turn to our second case study, the Peterborough Chronicle, and the scribal influences in W features. Here we are dealing with the third part, the entries from 1132 to 1154 of text E of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle preserved as Bodleian manuscript, Lord Miscellaneous 636. It can be shown that this third part was written in a hand completely different from those of the first two sections, and that the entries were made in Peterborough by a scribe from Peterborough in as a single block in 1155. The scribe was English, and this is particularly important to note here, as it has often been suggested that the irregular spellings that we find in those early manuscripts were due to Anglo-Norman influences. So we had Anglo-Norman scribes, supposedly, that didn't know the language and therefore mixed up the orthography, but here this is clearly not the case. So this was an English scribe who knew English, and so simply orthographic error cannot be the source for the variation that we find. So we can expect structured variation in those documents. In the present case, I'm interested in the variation of the spelling of the interdental fricatives. Scribes at that time could choose between eth and thorn, so two runic letters, and they had a new way of representing the interdental fricative, that is th. So th was the new form that came in at the time. It's important to note here that at least in Old English, but I think this is also true for early Middle English, thorn and eth were not distinguished by phonetic value. So this was not about having a th and a th. So that was not relevant here. There may be other factors which are important. Now, here you can see at the top that basically both allophones could be represented by all three forms. So at the top you have the representations of the voiceless interdental fricative in word initially, word medially, word finally, with thorn at the top, eth below, th at the bottom, and then you see the representations of the voiced interdental fricative in the word other, right? And that could be spelled with thorn, eth, and th. So you had a choice there. So we are clearly dealing with what McIntosh called the W features, so features that only have relevance for the writing system, for the orthography. This has nothing to do with phonological representations, we might think at first. In the edition of the Peterborough Chronicle produced by Cecily Clark in 1970, we find about 2,700 words and 384 occurrences of thorn, eth, and th. And table 1 describes their frequency in the manuscript. So you see 384 in total. The majority is thorn, about 70%, 15% eth, and 15% th. And we can break that down and look at various factors here represented in tables 2, 3, 4. it appears that th was introduced as a graph mainly to represent the voiced fricative allophone. This is what you could see in table 2 there. 70% of the th forms were used for the voiced interdental fricative. That's up here. With the others, you can see, well, that's 94% for the thorn, 91% for the eth. There's no statistical difference between the two, but this is significant over here. So th was introduced for the voiced form. Then you can also check for position in the word, so initially or finally versus medially. Again, this is just sheer coincidence that you see the same percentage, but it's true. Th was clearly preferred in a medial position here, and then you can summarize the whole thing as in table 4 here. And it seems that we have a slight preference, for instance, for thorn in grammatical words, which is over here, while th occurred more often in lexical items. Moreover, th was also common in initial and final position, as in the, as a result of what I call the unpacking of an assimilated form. When you look at the manuscript, you see that the scribe frequently uses a form which is like ante, which looks like that. So you have, oh, sorry. He uses the abbreviated form and then is following TE, ante. This is, of course, due to the fact that you have assimilation between the D and the T that makes it easier to pronounce. And I claim in a paper that the spelling the, which can be found elsewhere, not in this context, might in fact be an unpacking of this form. So if this is common, the scribe might think, okay, T is my one representation, and I can add the fricative quality by adding an H there, right? So he unpacks this sequence and turns the stop into a fricative by adding an H there in other contexts, instead of using the traditional thorn or eth, right? So he derives it back from this particular sequence, and this sequence, again, was motivated by assimilation, but you could not represent assimilated shortened the, because what do you do with those letters, right? You can't break them down. So it was helpful to have this sequence, which can be broken down into te, right, to represent the assimilation here. So, just almost finished. Eth, meanwhile, was used in only very few lexically conditioned cases and culturally prescribed spellings, so we only have one word, basically, which still has eth, that's that. We can assume that the scribe in the monastery was somewhat influenced by his predecessor, at least through reading the first continuation of the chronicle. The scribes of the first continuation wrote their texts in about 1131. The scribe we are analyzing here wrote his part in 1155, so there's only 24 years between them. It's also not unlikely that they came from the same area and they were educated in the same monastery. Clark says in her edition that, as Peterborough, I quote, as Peterborough monks, its writers were probably natives of the district. For in the late 12th century and in the 13th, established abbeys like Peterborough recruited their monks locally, and this was probably the practice in the earlier 12th century also, unquote. So there may have been a scribal tradition to spell that way. The interesting point now is that this scribe produced something like a one-hit wonder. TH as an innovative spelling remained extremely rare until about 200, 250 years later, and its use was extremely variable. A random sampling of Middle English texts shows that there are few overall results in general. You could see that with Maria's text. I mean, you still have Thorn there. But you can find it, for instance, in King Alexander, which has TH exclusively after Jog, in St. Kenhelm, where it's used only and exclusively word finally, in the Kentish sermons, which also have it, but they have it finally and in variation with Thorn and Teth. You have it in Havelock and the Cursa Mundi in very complex configurations. And in a beautiful poem called Patience, it's even used for aesthetic purposes because they do it like that. They say, thy, so they alternate between the two forms to create a sort of aesthetic effect with that. In sum, what does that mean? If we take Milroy's model of language change, which comprises speaker innovation as the initial act, followed by diffusion and therefore actuation, this is a most interesting story of a scribe as a potential agent of linguistic change. Here we have an innovator of a new W feature, but from all we can tell, the community resisted this incipient change. Why did the change not catch on, but only 300 years later? First, we may assume that the document was written by a monk called Hugh Candidus, a respected person in Peterborough, or one of his pupils. So, at least socially or socio-historically, there's no obvious reason why people didn't want to copy him, right? He was highly respected. On the other hand, there was no need or no demand for English documents at the time after the conquest. So maybe there was just not enough manuscript material to create a critical mass for this change to spread. In the end, however, we cannot tell for sure why a certain feature at a certain time caught on while others didn't. And I find it equally important to study the successful and the unsuccessful agents of linguistic change. In conclusion, I certainly do believe that scribes can be agents of linguistic change and that changes can spread through manuscripts and their readers or copyists. However, I'm a little bit more hesitant when we are dealing with author-scribe couples. And I explicitly exclude glossators here for a number of reasons, as we heard before. I believe that scribes were less influential on the levels of phonology, morphology, syntax, lexicon, and their influence of W features, however, can hardly be disputed. So in the realm of orthography, of course, obviously scribes were important. It's here that we find excellent test cases for our current socio-historical theories of language change. And we should pay close attention both to cases of actual changes and attempts of innovation. Thank you so much.